bit lard. I needed to keep to the side of the culinary road. I was warned to seek the safety of simple bread, butter, and cheese to sustain myself until I learned to decipher what was safe to eat. America was where anything could happen, a cowboy wild west of freedom, vice, plenty, and charm, where the boundaries were different and much, much wider. He knew what I did not. I would now be an outsider for the rest of my life. My parents' divorcing had made me one in India already. He wanted to arm me with as much information to pad my insertion into the world to come, because he knew that I had to become an American child. I could only hope to survive if I made that identity mine. And when I returned home, to India, I would be an outsider there too, because I had tasted the West. I realize now that he must have lavished me with so much attention to compensate for the permanent loss of my father and the spells spent without my mother, and perhaps because he knew the circumstances of my return. Regardless, his affections were in full force, and as they say, women often seek in their partners what they saw in their fathers. For me, my doting grandfather played that role. His were the qualities I came to crave, those of a mentor, an older, wiser man. Tata was my first mentor. It seems to me now that, over the years, rather than searching for other father figures, I perhaps searched for other mentors. Daniele was my second mentor. When I was a new model, fresh off the boat in Milan, here was a man with pedigree and choices, and he chose me. He was the perfect boyfriend for that period in my life, both cultural mentor and badge of my own worth. After my modeling career petered out, I started to crave approval from my mind, in many ways long dormant during my stint in fashion. Salman played the same role, times 10. My love for him was as real as it was for Daniele, but our emotional needs supply some of the kindling necessary for that initial spark. And whether you know it or not, they help define the at-first blurry vision of the man with whom you imagine yourself walking hand in hand. When I met Salman, I had just come off the ego boost of several years of modeling and co-hosting a talk show with the highest ratings in Italy. Yet moving back to the U.S., I left these successes behind and essentially started over. I had entered a much more competitive job market as a woman who was, by the harsh standards of show business, past her prime. My hard-won self-approval had begun to evaporate. When I was a girl, my confidence came from doing well at school, a goal set by a family full of strivers with graduate degrees. While I knew KCK and my mother were proud of my successes as a model, I also knew they expected more from the girl who idolized her high school English teacher and looked forward to academic Olympiad meetings as much as most girls did school dances. As my mom always reminded me whenever I sulked about some small failure in Milan or Paris, beauty is not an accomplishment. This was her way of comforting me by noting the arbitrary nature of the modeling world, where no matter how skilled you were at posing, walking, and talking, you landed jobs because of your God-given cheekbones and waistline. Yet, I also knew that while she was too kind to admit it, she had higher hopes for me. Salman mentored my intellect. After spending my 20s grooming my outer self and my manners, I was ready to groom my mind. His love and support gave me confidence to pursue my writing in a way I might not have without him. I began writing for magazines, as well as signed a second book contract. I started to consider new endeavors, a jewelry line and a line of teas and spices. Before my husband, I don't think I would have thought I was capable enough to attempt those things. He had buoyed me up and been a considerable, if unwitting, cheerleader. The way Salman made me take myself more seriously was not dissimilar to how my body image changed when someone like Helmut Newton thought differently of my scar. Surprise, surprise, Teddy was an older, more accomplished man. In other words, prime Padma bait. A worm to a fish to a bear, a mango to an Indian girl. This time, however, I wasn't biting, or so I thought. The recent failure of my marriage had convinced me that I needed to change my patterns. So unlike Salman's, Teddy's early calls went unanswered. Goodness knows he was persistent. He was used to getting his way. He'd call my office every 20 minutes if he couldn't reach me on my cell phone. He'd insist that my assistant slip me a note or pull me out of a meeting. At first I gave in out of pure fascination with this man. We were so different. I had gone to PS 158. He went to Andover. I liked boxing. He liked golf. I'm a bleeding heart liberal. He was quite the conservative. We started to spend more time with each other over the second half of that summer, in 2007, once I had moved in to the Surrey. Ours was not a perfect love story. It was an improbable one. When I first met Teddy, I could not imagine ever being involved with someone like him. Not only because of his age, but also because he was so utterly different from me in every way. He was a Republican, a staunch one, who displayed in his home framed photographs of himself with both George Bush Sr. and Jr. I'm a Democrat, and one whose libido was curtailed by having to look at such pictures, and I told him so. He removed them. He was also a faithful church-going Catholic, and when I say church-going, I mean he never, not ever, missed a Sunday Mass. Not when we were sailing in the Caribbean, and not when we went to Mumbai. In fact, even when he was in the Hamptons, he would arrange his return to the city based on whether he was going to attend church on Long Island or in Manhattan. Because his helicopter couldn't land in Southampton after sunset to pick him up, he'd have to plan on leaving in time to make Mass in the city. This meant missing a considerable part of his Sunday at the beach. But he did it, and without grumbling. I, by contrast, was a pretty secular Hindu, going to my local temple in Queens mostly on major holidays. Though after the temple installed a canteen in the basement, my family noticed a considerable spike in my piousness. They served the best masala dosas this side of Chennai. Teddy was from another time, chivalrous to a fault. He was very mindful of respecting boundaries, and he never strayed from the principles he lived by. In the beginning, after that trip to L.A. on his plane, we didn't really date. We had dinner a few times, often with his sons, and he always picked me up and dropped me off at my hotel's front door. My husband had never picked me up. We always met at the restaurant or event. The only time we arrived somewhere together was when we had left the house together and shared the taxi, which I usually hailed for us on our corner. But even beyond politics and religion, there was a comically large list of differences between us. Teddy was not adventurous with food by any means. He hated spicy food, preferred fried chicken to chicken curry, enjoyed steak and pot de creme, not tacos and falafel. He liked country music. He was very athletic, playing golf with Vijay Singh and tennis with the Bryan brothers regularly. I didn't know which end of the golf club was up. I only became sporty at 30 when my vanity kicked in and I took up boxing to stay fit. But Teddy and I connected emotionally, to both of our surprise. "I know what it takes to be on the outside looking in, Junior," he once said. He had always felt like a loner and excelled at compartmentalizing the disparate elements of his life. He had traveled so far spiritually from his early life in Connecticut, and all he had been through in the intervening years, more time than I'd been alive, gave him empathy for where I was now. He was the most confident man I have ever met. And yet, he confessed that there had been times when, before a big gamble, he'd been as afraid as a little boy. Teddy was old-fashioned in almost every way. Even though I had sought out a divorce months before we'd met, that first summer when I'd visit him at his home in the Hamptons, he'd insist on accommodating me in a guest room. This charmed me to no end, Finally, I thought, a man who gives me some space. But his adherence to decorum could also perplex me. Just before I moved into the Surrey, Dr. Sechkin performed another endo-related surgery on me. Teddy was considerably worried for my well-being, laid up as I was, alone again in that big house. He sent a bushel of flowers, but refused to come visit me because he said, "It isn't right to enter another man's house, even if we're only friends. I know what my intentions are in my heart, and I don't belong there." I had never met a man like him before. Teddy was so well-read, but he wore it lightly and by the end of the summer had devoured several tomes on the history of India and its independence, Churchill and Gandhi. He was a history buff, and he relished spouting obscure facts about Indian history at the dinner table, both to check my own knowledge and to irk me. But deep down, this seduced me too. I was touched that someone as busy as he was would voluntarily take serious free time to learn about my culture. Even with all his responsibilities at work, which included managing 4 companies, not just IMG, and his dedication to his 2 boys, he somehow made ample time to woo me and make me feel like he was always there. I didn't know where he got his energy. But while I was unbelievably lucky to have the full beam of his love shine on my life, I was also intimidated and overwhelmed by it. I had just left a situation where I felt I wasn't meeting someone's expectations of me, and I knew agreeing to be the partner or girlfriend of a man like Teddy came with similar requirements. In spite of all the wooing, I was strangely despondent. I wasn't ready for Teddy. I couldn't understand why such a person, or any person, could be that kind, that patient, without wanting anything in return from me, except my happiness. So whenever we began to get too close, I came up with a reason to back off. He was too old for me, too unlike me, too pushy. But every time I'd tell him I couldn't see him anymore, I found myself missing his counsel, his knowledge, his wicked sense of humor. I missed his presence. I had to exert effort not to call him. For a time, my practical side won out. Fortunately, he was Teddy, and he found ways to get his message across. He'd call my girlfriends and pull them out of meetings. His gumption makes me laugh now. I was, in my way, seeking mentorship from Teddy, too, pumping him for advice while I started my jewelry business and began to build my Easy Exotic spices and teas. Even though I was unsure I could be with him long-term, I thought he would impart to me a practical kind of entrepreneurial wisdom. But I was naive there, too. What Teddy wound up schooling me in was not business acumen, although he did indulge my every question and query and help me develop that aspect of myself, too. Teddy taught me about kindness, about love that is unconditional, a sentiment not dependent on acceptance, approval, or the expectation of something in return. It was the first time I would ever feel this from a man who wasn't my grandfather. And I didn't know what to do with it at all. If only I'd embraced our differences sooner. I didn't know it then, but we had so little time left. Chapter 10. He called me Junior. Occasionally, he'd call me Madam, when he wanted to make me the bad cop, as in, "I'd be happy to join you at the Red Sox game, but Madam will never go for that." But he used Junior the most, his way of poking fun, not just at our vast age difference, but also my fixation on it. I called him Duke. We came up with his nickname on a trip we took to India in the spring of 2008. Teddy had never been to India. 4 times before we met, he had planned to travel there on business, had even received the requisite immunizations, only to cancel his plans at the last minute. India seemed a world away to him, and I could tell the whole idea made him tired. But I also knew the country and its history fascinated him. He felt that to fully realize his goals of expanding his company's interests, he would surely need to confront India at some point. Having me in tow to be a guide of sorts made the trip more surmountable. A few of his employees even took bets on whether he'd actually make it there. Tom Ritz lost money, but he was pleased for us. We were going to be staying in Jaipur, Rajasthan, at the Taj Rambagh Palace, once the residence of the Maharaja of Jaipur, which his family now operated as a lavish hotel. Teddy made the reservation. I had told him not to give them my real name. I often used an alias to check into hotels to avoid unwanted attention. To keep the ruse simple, I always used the same name, which was, as a nod to my family who might need to find me, my uncle's surname, Nathan. My full alias was Dr. P. Nathan. Teddy thought this was hilarious. "Oh, what, you're a Jewish orthopedist now?" he joked the first time he heard it. Then gleefully set out to come up with his own nom de hotel. I rejected out of hand his first suggestion, Pee Wee Reese, the name of one of his favorite baseball players. "A real star," he said, smirking, "in the 40s and 50s. Again, because he knew it bugged me, he took great pleasure in underscoring his age. The point, I reminded him, was to be inconspicuous. Pee Wee Reese was anything but. So we chose the name of another player, Duke Snyder, a name recognizable to fans, maybe, but sufficiently unobtrusive for our jaunt in South Asia. On our last night at the hotel, we returned to our room to a letter bearing a royal seal. Teddy opened it. It was from the grandson of the Maharaja, who ran the hotel. His grandfather, he wrote, had been a Brooklyn Dodgers fanatic and would have been honored to know that Duke Snyder was staying at his residence. Teddy loved this letter. When we got home, he had it framed and hung it in his office next to Mandela's tin plate. And so we were Duke and Junior. We made an odd pair. As I said, we didn't pray to the same God or like the same foods. Let me tell you, though, that of the two, our Hindu-Catholic union was nowhere near as troublesome for me as our gastronomic mismatch. For such a worldly man, his tastes were shockingly pedestrian. When we were together in India, he subsisted almost exclusively on scrambled eggs, toast, and club sandwiches with ketchup. In fact, everywhere we went, he ate club sandwiches. I teased him that he was single-handedly responsible for the club sandwich's omnipresence on room service menus throughout the world. He loved steak and Italian food, especially when we were eating them at stalwart Manhattan restaurants like Sistina, Elio's, and Il Molino, where the waiters wore ties, the customers were important, and the portions were large. What made his culinary limitations even more fascinating to me was that they existed despite his ability to eat anything, anywhere he damn well pleased. Someone of his means could fly to Tokyo on a Monday just to eat uni and otoro at Tsukiyabashi Jiro. He could lunch the next day at L'Arpège in Paris and then pop over to Catalonia to grab a late dinner at El Bulli. But for Teddy, the height of culinary achievement was a dry-age ribeye. While I've been known to ramble on about succulent this and glistening that, the highest compliment he could pay any food was, "Now that's a good-looking steak." At first, his stubbornness frustrated me. I wanted to share my love of food, my conviction that food could be, no, was, an adventure with him. But I grew to love that about him. He made no pretense about his food preferences. And when you hang around ramen obsessives and fried chicken fanatics, as I happily do, someone who has no great interest in food can actually be a refreshing presence, a reminder of how much else there is to experience. As he gently chided me, "I know Picasso, Junior. You know pasta." Part of the fun we had was catering to each other's desires, though he was both a better caterer and a better sport. Sure, I didn't gripe when Teddy flew in for dinner while I was filming Top Chef Chicago and insisted on dining at Gibson's, even though I was already gorged and distended. The steakhouse seemed to specialize in Flintstonian-sized portions. His ribeye looked like it clocked in at just under 5 pounds. Even my Caesar salad came in what appeared to be a small rowboat. Teddy, however, did a lot more than not gripe when I got an itch to try somewhere or something new. In the fall of 2009, for no particular reason at all, not my birthday, not Valentine's Day, he told me he wanted to take me on a fantasy food tour. "You choose the restaurants," he said. "I'll get you there." I named the two most exciting places in the world I could think of. He told me to pack my bags. Our first stop was to be El Bulli. A week or two before the meal, Ferran Adria, the chef of El Bulli, very kindly emailed to ask if we had any allergies. "Thank you for asking," I wrote, before I began my lengthy catalog of Teddy's aversions. Olives, oysters, chilies. Destination number two was Noma, the legendary Copenhagen restaurant. The food at Noma was Teddy's worst nightmare, whereas I couldn't have been more excited to try René Redzepi's pioneering neo-Nordic cuisine. I'd read all about the young phenom's fetish for foraging, for resurrecting ingredients once eaten but long forgotten, like tree bark, moss, and ants. Redzepi was famous for using almost exclusively products found or produced in the Nordic region. Sea buckhorn, cloudberries, wild sorrel. His dishes reveal the arbitrary nature of our food system. We eat such a small portion of what's edible. Most of us pay dearly for pre-washed arugula, even as we trample edible and delicious dandelions on the way home. To eat at Noma is to be transported to a very particular place, away from the world in which food travels thousands of miles before it reaches you, the world in which, no matter your location, you always have access to tomatoes, lemons, and cumin. Each dish at Noma disorients, and gloriously so. The ingredients provide a window into the past, while the presentation and techniques abut the future. To Teddy, the restaurant was nonsense. His proof came with the first course. Seated at our blonde wood table, adorned with the usual stemware plates and a vase filled with a few red flowers, we watched as our waiter arrived empty-handed. With a smile, he told us that our first course had already arrived. "Where?" we said as we stared down at the empty plates in front of us. "Right here," he said, gesturing at the vase. The flowers in it were nasturtiums, delicate and sweet, with a nose-tickling radish-like bite. And tucked inside each one was a surprise. An edible snail. What I thought were decorative sticks were actually malt bread. I thrilled at the playful trick. In such a beautiful restaurant, I felt the desire to fully experience it, to revel in every moment, every sight and sound. Now I was told I could experience a small part of this beauty through the most intimate act, eating it. Teddy's response was classic Teddy. "The best restaurant in the world, and they're serving me a flower? I have hydrangeas in my garden that look more delicious than this." Not only was I asking him to eat a flower and a slug, but he was also paying through the nose for the pleasure. When the next course arrived, Teddy looked down at his ice-filled mason jar set in front of us. It held 2 shrimp, each one about the size of my pinky. "Okay, Junior, what are we eating?" he asked. I told him what the waiter had told me. We were supposed to dip the shrimp in the emulsified brown butter provided, then pop them whole into our mouths. Oh, and did I mention the shrimp were still alive? "No way I'm eating mine," he said. "He's too cute," disguising his disgust with empathy. I grabbed one. As I contemplated my task, it was complicated by the shrimp, which had started to move. Teddy picked up one of his, and soon it was moving too. I finally summoned the courage to eat mine when he decided that in their writhing, the two little guys resembled tennis players swinging tiny, imaginary rackets. When he dubbed them Raphael and Roger, I put mine down for good. I couldn't have had a better companion for this meal than Teddy. Not despite his teasing, but because of it. Meals like this are part cooking, part performance art. They toe the line between the sublime and the absurd, between decadence and debauchery. On which side of that line they ultimately fall depends on the chef, but also on the diner. Teddy kept me grounded. He reminded me that while this was swoon-worthy food that bordered on art, it was still just food. Exaggerated derision figured prominently in our repartee. It was the way we coped with our differences, which I felt were many. During the first hour of an afternoon spent watching golf, I'd groan, "How can you like this, Duke? It's just men in funny pants walking. I don't get it." Or I would gripe at the frequency with which he ate steak. "Well, I guess someone has to keep the cattle growers happy." But even as he made fun of my love for dishes, featuring chickweed and white currants and bleak roe, he indulged it. He took great pleasure in seeing me happy. To see Teddy at Basement Bhangra was to understand the extent of his devotion. Basement Bhangra is a once-a-month dance party at a club in Manhattan. Back then it was at SOBs, but at the time drew hordes of Punjabi grad students and other subcontinentally inclined dancers who grooved to North Indian music fused with hip-hop. The effect was a sort of cross between a high school dance and a disco hoedown. This was my happy place. To Teddy, who preferred Fleetwood Mac and Mozart and despised dancing, it was a hellscape. But nonetheless, he came. And in the sea of brown, young, sweaty bodies, Teddy stood out like, well, a 68-year-old white guy. Because practically everyone in attendance at Basement Bhangra was Indian, I went resigned to being recognized. There were some stares and the occasional awkward conversation, each party straining to be heard above the bass. But the time I brought Teddy was different. People would still approach me, and I'd prepare my cheery, "Yes, I'm Padma Lakshmi, nice to meet you," smile. "Is that who I think it is?" they'd ask, motioning toward my companion. "Is that really Teddy Forsman?" These were MBA students, after all, far more interested in spotting the man who came out early against junk bonds than the woman best known for hosting a cable cooking show. The closer I felt to Teddy, the stronger my practical side pushed back. Part of this was deeply buried guilt. The age difference between me and Salman had, I believed, played a major part in the undoing of our marriage. I had told Salman this, and I believed it was true. Being with Teddy made me feel like a hypocrite. I couldn't help thinking about how Salman would feel when he heard the gossip. I felt ashamed and very mixed up. For 2 years, I told Teddy I didn't want a relationship, that I wasn't ready for one, and that even when I would be, I wasn't sure he'd be the appropriate choice, even as we spent more and more time together and grew closer and closer. Whenever something good happened, Teddy was the first person I called. Whenever I needed advice about work, or to vent, or was scared, I called Teddy. We were thick as thieves and intermittently lovers, and I somehow convinced myself if I kept telling him I couldn't handle being in a committed relationship with him, I could keep us from getting too entangled romantically, yet preserve a friendship that was the main source of comfort and support at the time. But it was too late. We were already entangled. I just didn't want to accept it. Part of me just wanted to play the field, honestly, as cruel as that is. For practically the first time in my adult life, I was single. Until that point, my romantic life had consisted of a series of serious, committed relationships, from my college boyfriend to Daniele to my husband. In the short time between my move back to the U.S. and the day I met Salman, I had briefly dated, but that was the extent of my life as a bachelorette. Now, I had little desire to be anyone else's wife or main squeeze. I had had enough of smiling silently at all the fancy dinners, All the events that blurred into one another in a daze of cocktail dresses, champagne, cultured small talk, and hurt feelings at the end of the night. All this don't tread on my freedom stuff was just catnip to Teddy. There was nothing he liked more than a challenge, and after a lifetime of being chased by women who wanted to do nothing but pin him down, my loner vibe appealed immensely. And Teddy loved the idea of coming to someone's rescue. He had ample practice at it, given his own personal history with his father, who suffered from alcoholism and other issues, and often took out his frustrations on his mother. Teddy hated bullies, and always rooted for the underdog. I had certainly filled his ears full of all my insecurities about making it without my husband and finding my own way. He could see I was scared, incredibly disillusioned about love, burned by bad experience, and just wanting the world to go away. Teddy would not go away. Somewhat early in our push-pull, come-closer-now-go-away routine, I met a man named Adam Dell. It was November 19th, 2007, and I was on a book tour for my second cookbook, doing a signing at the Strand bookstore. It was also the day I would find a listing for what would become my first home. I remember using the folded sheet from the realtor as my bookmark. A mutual friend brought Adam to the signing, and afterwards we all went out to a small dinner thrown for me by my friend Luca. Later that night, we went dancing, and I liked how dainty I felt in contrast to Adam's tall, broad-shouldered frame. I was with friends, letting loose after a horrendous year and a grueling book tour while at the tail end of a public divorce. It was therapeutic to just dance and not talk. I felt liberated to a certain degree. He seemed to slip in easily among my friends and asked very little of me. There was a strong kinetic attraction between us. Nothing verbalized or analyzed, but it was hanging in the air, daring me to do something about it. At that moment in time, just 2 months after my divorce, I didn't trust my feelings about anything, and indeed was anxious not to feel anything, really, for anyone. Adam was about as different from Teddy, or Salman for that matter, as you can imagine. He was, for a start, my age. I hadn't been with someone my age since college. Adam was fun, liked Led Zeppelin and spicy food, and felt to me like the prom date I never had. He ignited a certain playfulness in me. I didn't know much about Adam, and I really didn't investigate, because I felt I had enough on my plate as it was. Over the course of my book tour, we kept in touch via occasional text. I didn't see him again until the following month in L.A., when I went to do an appearance on The Ellen Show. Then I saw him once more a month after that in mid-January on his birthday. I had just returned from a New Year's holiday with Teddy. To commemorate my new life as a divorcee, Teddy had charmingly rented a beautiful boat named the New Vita. I was looking forward to the year ahead, hopeful and expectant. So I kept seeing both men. My relationship with Adam illustrated to Teddy that I meant business about dating other people. But after a couple of weeks with Adam, I would get bored. I would miss Teddy terribly. I missed the verbal jousting, the wit, the all-consuming roller coaster that being with this charismatic man entailed. The whole thing was deeply unfair to Adam because he never really stood a chance. No matter how easygoing and amenable he was to anything I threw his way, no matter how charming or thoughtful or fun, the fact was, my heart already belonged to Teddy, whether I wanted to admit it or not. I would spend the better part of 2008 feeling that while it was exciting to have two such different men court me, I probably wouldn't wind up with either of them. I had very different experiences with each man. I rationalized that since I had been clear with both men about not wanting a serious relationship, and that I told them both I was dating other people, this made everything all right. That it was perfectly acceptable to date them both, even though I knew they both wanted more. I disregarded what I knew were serious feelings on both their parts. But beyond my own self-absorption and my lack of concern for whether I was hurting either Teddy or Adam, my feminist and willful side had kicked in. Why couldn't I date more than one man? Men did it all the time without compunction. While I had a right to my own freedom, I didn't look too far into the future to consider the consequences of my actions. The heart wants what it wants, and it hears only what it wants to hear. Neither of the relationships I was juggling felt as casual to these men as I was treating them. And if I had stopped to investigate my own heart honestly, I would have seen that while I was utterly taken with Teddy, or occupied with Adam, I still sorely missed Salman. I didn't want to go back to my marriage, but the truth is that I wasn't over my ex-husband. I was rudderless and should have made myself be alone. Chapter 11. That same desire to take ownership of and forge a new life for myself on my own terms had also been driving me to find a home I could call my own. A home I owned, a place that belonged solely to me, that wasn't contingent on a husband or a landlord or anything else. Freshly divorced, I had experienced a wound of displacement and homelessness moving into the Surrey that had just started to truly heal. I did not want to reopen it, ever. On a snowy day in January 2008, I unlocked the door to a home of my own, my first. The cute two-bedroom Alphabet City apartment on the fifth floor of an old brick tenement was a far cry from the Park Avenue townhouse I had spent the last few years in. But the place was all mine. I loved every inch of it. The neighborhood, too, was a vast change from the historically landmarked street on which my marital home stood. At the time, Alphabet City still had a lot of rats scurrying around car tires in the night. The sidewalk outside my building often gave off the faint stench of stale urine and vomit, splattered there by the nightly young bar hoppers. But I loved the neighborhood's gothic weeping willows and scrappy communal gardens with their metal sculptures rusting under the heavy snow. And my little oasis was the quintessential image of what outsiders think a downtown New York apartment should look like. It had an open-plan kitchen with wooden cabinets I ripped the doors off of and painted Moroccan red. The spare room had a load-bearing wall with two arches in the middle of it, but I made it work because I turned one half into a writing room and the other half into my dressing room. I made it as girly and feminine as humanly possible. My ancient Egyptian costumes from the Ten Commandments, along with various gowns and baubles I had been gifted over the years of modeling, hung everywhere. It was wonderful just to have all my books and pictures back around me. 6 months of being a gypsy and living in hotels and guest rooms had begun to wear me thin and jangle my nerves. I relished having my own space again. And the best part? I was finally in my own kitchen once more. The first thing I did was unpack the pots and pans and cooking utensils. I wasn't really sure what to do with the half-set of Tiffany's wedding china, but I was so giddy about being able to cook in my own kitchen again that I lost any of the rancor I'd had about the inevitable division of goods that is part and parcel of a marital breakup. I thoroughly savored going to Kalustian's, my old standby gourmet ethnic store, and buying all my pantry ingredients. I lingered lovingly in their spice aisles like a bookworm in the stacks of an old library. I filled my basket with ras al hanout, baharat, urfa chili and sumac, green mango powder and za'atar, bottles of obscure hot sauces, yuzu and rose jam. I was in heaven. I went to Artisanal's Cheese Cave and splurged on everything that Chantal, my crusty French cheesemonger with a gravelly voice and perpetually smudged cobalt blue eyeliner, made me taste. Small, putty-like wheels of goat cheese soaked in eau de vie and wrapped in grape leaves. A fluorescent wedge of mimolette, cracked and pungent and briny. And an oozing, stinky round of camembert. I spent endless hours perusing the shelves of Pearl River Mart, picking out all manner of bowls, from large to tiny, from which I slurped everything from noodles to pasta to ice cream. I went to Patel Brothers Supermarket in Jackson Heights, loading up on fresh white turmeric and green mangoes and tindora, a small Asian squash that is my favorite vegetable. I replaced the many jars of oily Indian pickles I had to leave behind when I became a hotel vagabond. I was reunited with the sublime mouthfeel of cold salted yogurt and rice, spiced with crunchy fried mustard seeds, a dollop of various beloved pickles nestled into each bite. I cannot remember the first complete meal I cooked in that kitchen in the East Village, although I know for a fact it must have contained a lot of aromatic sambar curry powder, because it was this taste, this remnant of home cooking, I longed for most in those last 6 nomadic months of misery. Teddy had been very generous with his living quarters. Upon coming home one afternoon and discovering me in his kitchen, Teddy encouraged me to cook there whenever I wanted. He said no one other than his housekeeper had cooked him a midday meal in years, and the sight of me in an apron moved him almost as much as the indigestion he suffered later from the spicy lunch itself. After that, I was careful not to pollute his tony Fifth Avenue penthouse with the odors of the subcontinent. Even though his kids loved Indian food, they'd eaten it in South Africa often. But now I was home, in my home, home, once and for all. I'd had various apartments before in quite a few cities over the course of my life, but this was the first one I owned, and it felt good. A roof over my head, and a place to be private, to cry, to laugh, to gorge, to hope, to dream, to wallow, and to pray for things, was a salve to my soul, and cooking was indeed my salvation. I made the staple chutneys and condiments I used regularly, like thick, pasty cranberry chutney with cayenne and fenugreek. I boiled carcasses in a heap of vegetables and aromatics for stock I could freeze. I spent whole weekends in the dead of winter filling tall canisters with lentils and pulses of every color. I bought black rice, red rice, brown rice, and of course basmati rice by the heavy jute sackful. I replenished my cupboards with all those rare and funky things I had discovered over my many years of travel. Dried black Omani limes and Sichuan peppercorns, kokum fruit skins and tins of glittering pieces of orange glacé. Some friends tried to remind me I was living alone and surely wouldn't need all of this, but they didn't get it. It comforted me to have all these twigs and leaves stuffed into my larder. On those new red shelves, I sought to replicate my grandmother's storeroom. I never wanted to leave the house again. By my 38th birthday that September, I finally began to feel like I was getting my life fully back on track. I had settled into my new apartment. The show was doing really well. We had been nominated for an Emmy every single season since I had started, and though I in no way felt significantly responsible for this, it set me at ease about whether or not I truly belonged there. I had renegotiated a much better contract with the network, too, and I was beginning to take on other business ventures. I hadn't felt comfortable or confident about money since the height of my modeling days, and back then it had troubled me that my material security was based on my looks, which I neither had earned nor could count on in perpetuity. Now I made a living from my knowledge and skills and my effort. I was self-reliant, and this feeling, this sense that I would indeed make it on my own, was crucial to restoring my faith in myself. Somewhere in the middle of all the back and forth between Top Chef and Teddy and Adam that year, I had started to worry that I wouldn't get my act together in time to bear children. Despite my endometriosis, I hadn't given up on being a mother. And now I had enough money in the bank to splurge on freezing my eggs, something Sechkin also vehemently encouraged me to do. But in order to do so, I was required to first undergo a battery of expensive hormone tests. Sechkin referred me to a fertility specialist, and as 2008 came to a close, I made the appointment. Early that winter, I dutifully took the tests. I was confident, or at least hopeful, while I awaited the results. When the fertility doctor called with my test results, I was making breakfast. I had just scrambled some eggs and delivered them to a crisp slice of sourdough and drizzled the whole yummy thing with Tapatio hot sauce. I sat on my couch, the plate perched on my knees as the doctor leveled with me. The stress of my disease had taken a toll on my body. My ovaries, he told me, with a typical medical professional's tact, were effectively even older than I was. Aging is hard enough on a superficial level. Your favorite features begin to wilt, like fresh basil left out too long. The last thing you want to hear when you're staring down the barrel of 40 is the discourteous surprise that your insides are even older. Still worse, he told me that it was highly unlikely I could conceive naturally, the old-fashioned way, in his phrasing. Fine, to hell with the old-fashioned way. What about in vitro fertilization? Even if we harvested my eggs, he said, after daily injections meant to pump my system into egg-laying overdrive before my ovaries officially threw in the towel, my chances were just 10 to 15% at best. By the time I hung up the phone, my scrambled eggs were cold. I picked up my breakfast and tried to take a bite. The toast, now damp, had lost its will under the pile of curds. The bread gave way, sending egg onto my sweatpants. The bit of curd looked like vomit, the hot sauce and egg and toast seeping their moisture into my sweatpants and the velvet couch. And vomiting was just what I felt like doing. I had squandered the best years of my life, following Salman around the globe, going to amazing parties and grand literary dinners where he held court. But I had not tended to those parts of my womanhood that needed the most care. I knew something had been wrong, and had just pushed it away, repeatedly, while time marched on. I imagined my insides like those eggs. What I had once thought of as so healthy, full of vitality and life, now seemed to be a useless, deflated mess. My desire to be a mother had played a significant part in the excruciating decision to end my marriage. I couldn't imagine introducing a child into our volatile relationship, so I had to end it and move on. Now I wondered, had I left a man who, despite all his faults, truly loved me, just to chase a fantasy? Would I end up both childless and alone? The fact that I had two men in my life but had trouble fully committing to either one of them didn't help matters. I had just come back from a Christmas trip to India with Adam and decided that while our holiday had been enjoyable, we didn't have enough between us to sustain my attention in the relationship. I just wasn't engaged enough mentally or emotionally. I called Sechkin to tell him what the fertility specialist had said. I began to choke on my own cursing words as big, fat, rolling drops of salty water tumbled from my eyes. I felt so stupid for not getting to the bottom of what I knew was wrong all those years. I couldn't help it. Had I not valued myself enough to investigate all of the signs, month after month, year after year? Rage and self-pity swirled in my stomach at the thought of being barren. I thought about how, during my first surgery with Dr. Sechkin in 2006, he had made the grim discovery that I was missing part of an ovary. It had been removed by a previous doctor, who I suppose had decided to keep the news of the collateral damage to himself. When I had come to, after my fourth, or was it my fifth, surgery just past May of 2008, Dr. Sechkin told me gently that he'd had to remove my right fallopian tube. He had prepared me for this possibility, but still, it stung. I was 37, with half my equipment gone. Had I found Sechkin earlier, I could have saved my left ovary, I could have kept my right fallopian tube, and I may even have been able to salvage my marriage. Several weeks later, during a brutal New York winter, I walked to yet another doctor's office, past leafless trees that sent their spindly branches toward the sky. This meeting was to set a plan in preparation for harvesting eggs once my body was primed. In the early spring, after 3 months of vitamin supplements, hormone injections and blood tests, and many thousands of dollars in bills, the doctor harvested 3 eggs. Today I still think about them, frozen, occupying space in Midtown Manhattan, in a room behind one of those thousands of windows you think nothing of as you walk past. I froze my eggs, something every woman who has the means to should do by 30 if she hasn't had children and has the faintest interest of being a parent, just as insurance. I wished someone had told me that a decade earlier. I got 3 little eggs. But a few years earlier, I might have gotten much more with the same effort and cost. My gratitude for finding Sechkin remained, but I began to be angry that I hadn't had treatment earlier. I was outraged that in spite of all the best health insurance and access to medical care on both U.S. coasts as well as in London, I had been undiagnosed and misdiagnosed well into my mid-30s. And now, with half my left ovary missing and a right fallopian tube gone, I started to confront the fact that all this could have been avoided. Neela's daughter, my young cousin Akshara, always creative and articulate and brash, began to have problems with her periods. On trips to India, I saw her suffer. Her whole mood would change. I remembered being rushed to Mount Sinai and having gastric surgery to treat the symptoms when I should have been there to treat the cause. If I had known at 18, at 22, or 26, or even 30 what was going on, I could have much more easily ensured my ability to have children. I could have had a hand in my own destiny, rather than expect it to miraculously be what the world told me it should. We take so much for granted. Most of all, ourselves. In my mother's generation, if things got really bad, they'd just give you a hysterectomy. In fact, endometriosis is the number one reason women get hysterectomies. But now, we have the technology and research to treat the illness. While there is still no cure, there's ample treatment. And now that I was on the other side of that pain, I could see how much the disease had stained the very fabric of my life. I had missed a week out of every month because of pain that drove me to my bed, with painkillers and heating pads. I had effectively forfeited 25% of my life to this malaise. I was so angry that I would never get all that time back, all those missed opportunities, all the events of my life that I had to sit out of, barred by my own body. I didn't want the next generation of women to go through what I and millions of women went through every month. I could see how significantly my life would have been different if I had had treatment in my early 20s instead of at 36. I thought of Akshara and her sister just beginning their adult lives. I hadn't been saved from the dread of my period those 23 years, but perhaps if I'd warned these young girls, they could be saved from what I went through. If we could get the word out, maybe this generation of mothers wouldn't tell their daughters what ours told us, what they had been told by their mothers. This is not our lot in life. It doesn't have to be. There are so many things in this world that aren't treatable, but this disease certainly is. Pain, after all, is your body's way of telling you something is wrong. Sechkin had been asking me intermittently to speak to a few young patients who were going through the same thing I had gone through. These women had been afraid to get the surgery, or just had been having a hard time for whatever reason because of endometriosis. It is a very isolating disease. He felt that if they could talk with a neutral person outside their family who had been through it, they would feel less alone. They could also see through my journey that there was hope. And they could, perhaps, feel better. Once, a young girl stopped me in Sechkin's office as I walked out after an appointment. She was very excited, explaining what a die-hard fan of Top Chef she was. I could feel the remains of the jelly from the vaginal sonogram I'd just had seeping into the crotch of my underwear. The girl quoted several of my quips from Judge's Table and listed her favorite episodes, many of which I had trouble remembering at that very awkward moment. It was the only time I could think of that I wasn't altogether pleased to accept a compliment on behalf of our show. Sechkin called later that evening to ask if I would get in touch with the same young girl. She had initially been helped by the pill, he said, but now she needed surgery and was reluctant to go through with it. She had what seemed like a rather tenuous relationship with her mother, at least from what the doctor could tell by their behavior in his office during visits. Sechkin thought that she would respond to my reaching out because she was such a fan. He connected me with other patients a few times, informally and ad hoc, and it had proved therapeutic, helpful in some way to them too. Sechkin had already organized a small patient support group, and I met one of his other ex-patients who helped out. There were lawyers, financial professionals, women from many walks of life, all suffering from the same disease and giving one another support and listening when no one else would. Sechkin saw the effects of our efforts and was seized by the idea that we should co-found a formal organization dedicated to endometriosis research and education. At first, I resisted. I didn't know anything about running a foundation, and from what I could tell, the doc was always busy and his practice was overflowing, so I wasn't sure how we were going to pull it all off. And also, I felt that talking about endometriosis was frankly the most unsexy thing in the world, that it would seal the coffin on any appeal I had left in the world past 40. I was so conditioned into thinking, ever since those early modeling days in Spain, that if I drew the curtain back on such an uncomfortable and almost disgusting thing that had been happening to me all along, I would extinguish any interest or attraction the public had in me. It was embarrassing to even consider talking in print and on stage about my illness. And who would listen anyway? But I had seen how profoundly my life had changed since the surgeries. My pain, my discomfort, my moods, my ability to handle stress. My gratitude for Sechkin's treatment made me want to talk to each of those patients in his office. Sechkin had alleviated so much pain and suffering for me that I couldn't in good conscience say no to his foundation proposal. Still, he lobbied for a whole 6 months before I finally acquiesced. And so, in April of 2009, we launched the Endometriosis Foundation of America, with funds cobbled together largely from Sechkin, along with a lot of goodwill. We formed a board, mainly out of the most active members of his patients group, and asked his wife to help out too. He and I worked our Rolodexes to death and begged everyone we knew to help and buy tickets to a fundraiser we were calling the Blossom Ball, which we threw together in 60 days. It felt good to channel my anger toward a cause and turn my pain into something positive. I had to learn how to speak about my illness publicly, and the practice I'd had in the many counseling sessions with Sechkin's other patients was not enough. But I learned quickly. I had no choice. To try to get the word out, we all thought I needed to tell my story with candor to one big news organization to garner support and interest in our mission. We needed to raise awareness so other women wouldn't have to go through what I had. I asked my publicist and friend Christina if she could help spread the word about our new foundation. This was much different than the usual press junkets of talk shows and magazine interviews she worked on for Top Chef, but she was happy to try. I started telling her all about it, and she helped me hone my message and navigate how to tell a very personal and, quite frankly, squeamish story to strangers in a public forum. I practiced on the phone with her late into the night before our fundraiser and tried to subdue the considerable embarrassment I felt about, well, talking about my vagina. I agreed to an interview with Newsweek. I had already been on their cover and felt they would treat the interview fairly and respectfully. The first Blossom Ball was a success, mostly because we shanghaied our friends and colleagues into helping. Whoopi Goldberg, who, it turned out, was also a sufferer, agreed to speak at the last minute, and Fareed Zakaria agreed to MC. I was really nervous about speaking about such private things to a journalist. I had been burned so much, especially as it related to my private life, that I felt very shaky about the whole thing. But I kept thinking of my young cousin. I kept thinking of all the young girls I passed in the street, knowing that 10% of them were walking around feeling like I did, every month, for years and years. I thought of the women who lived in the public housing near my place downtown, who probably didn't have the health insurance I had, or the regular checkups, and how they could afford even less than I could to miss all those days of work. I thought of my mother on her heating pad, how a doctor had removed her appendix. I thought of the rejection on my ex-husband's face and his utter lack of understanding or empathy or even belief that I was actually in the pain I said I was in. After the Blossom Ball, I went off to film in Vegas. Teddy flew in for weekly overnight visits. I had abandoned the use of any birth control as unnecessary. I was in a very bad mood for most of the filming.